WMFO Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there is no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Pre-recorded.
Thank you, Digital Henry. Good morning. It's the 28th of April, 2021. My name is Arthur. I'm going to go across the pond this week and play a couple of British dramas. The first being The New Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, The Case of the Out-of-Date Murder. This was an Armed Forces Radio Service broadcast, so I don't know if you listen to the end, it also says mutual, so I don't know if the original air date of the 7th of September 1945 is from the Armed Services rebroadcasting the original one. But anyway, thanks for listening.
This episode from the life of Sherlock Holmes will be transmitted to our men and women overseas by shortwave and through the worldwide facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Petri Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to Dr. Watson tell us another exciting story about his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes. And we'd also like to tell you something you really ought to know. The fact that the one sure way to make good food taste better is to try that good food together with a glass of good Petri wine. Did you ever try Petri wine with dinner? No kidding, that's one bandwagon you sure want to hop on. Take, for instance, a deep red, hearty Petri California Burgundy. Wait till you taste that Petri Burgundy with, let's say, a delicious old-fashioned beef stew. Or maybe try a glass with spaghetti. I'm telling you, when you add the luscious flavor of that Petri Burgundy with the flavor of your favorite foods, you're really living. You're finding out for the first time what good eating really means, on the level. So better keep a bottle of that Petri Burgundy right on the dining room table. And never forget, the best friend a good meal ever had is a glass of Petri wine. And now for our weekly visit with the good Dr. Watson. May I come in, Doctor?
No, Mr. Bartell. You know me better than that. Of course you can come in. I'm expecting you. I always look forward to these Monday evenings together, you know.
Me too, Doctor. In fact, I always say this is the one doctor's appointment that never scares me.
Oh, that's very nice of you, my boy. Draw up your chair and make yourself comfortable.
Thanks. And what prescription do you have in mind for us tonight, Doctor?
Well, now, let me see. Take one measure of subterranean peril, one of aristocratic lady in distress, a sprinkling of assorted villains, a corpse or two, and a little more than a dash of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Shake the mixture well, and you have the case of the out-of-date murder.
Well, how did the adventure begin, Doctor?
Exactly enough. It was in September of 1900. I remember that Holmes and I went to Eastbourne for a much-needed rest. First couple of days we spent in soothing idleness. On the morning of the third day, Holmes, a dash of color back in his cheek and a hint of the old sparkle in his eye, suggested that he should go and call on his good friend Evan Whitnell, curator of a nearby museum. And so, just after lunch on that September day, found the two of us talking to Professor Evan Whitnell in his private office at the museum. It only seems yesterday.
Professor Whitnell, your recent discoveries in this part of England have made you world famous instead of just nationally famous. My congratulations.
Professor, I do wish you'd tell me about your discoveries.
Well, with pleasure, Dr. Watson. Less than 2 months ago, I was excavating on the downlands in this neighborhood when I was fortunate enough to discover a number of underground caves. Caves saturated with a heavy deposit of lime that gave clear evidence of having the property of rapidly mummifying any flesh, human or animal, deposited in them.
Gracious me, it's interesting. And what treasures have you unearthed, Professor?
Well, a number of mummified specimens of animals clearly belonging to bygone eras. My prize specimen is the body of a large wolfhound. The inscription on its collar identified the animal as having belonged to some local squire in the year 1748.
Amazing. I didn't know that limestone had such qualities of preservation.
Come in, come in. Yes, Alan? What is it?
Lady Clavering, Professor. She asked me to tell you that she was in a museum.
Oh, yes, 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 sir. Show her up here, will you, Alan?
Very good, sir.
Yes, I'm most anxious for you both to meet her. And she, in turn, is even more anxious to meet you. Now, I dined with her last night. And when I told her that you were coming here today, she insisted on meeting you.
Oh, Whitnall, you scoundrel. There's a twinkle in your eye. I suspect that Lady Clavering is here to consult me in my professional capacity and that you engineered the meeting.
Well, perhaps I might have dropped a hint.
No, I warn you, Professor. Holmes can't become involved with another case. He's completely run down.
Well, don't worry, Doctor. All that Lady Clavering requires is a little advice.
Advice? Oh, that's a different matter altogether.
Yes, sir. I knew you wouldn't mind, Holmes. Ah, Helena, my dear, there you are. Come along in. Thank you, Alan. Allow me to introduce Lady Clavering, Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson.
How do you do?
How are you, gentlemen?
Now, there you are, my dear. Sit down here. I may as well tell you, Helena, that our little plot has already been discovered.
Oh, dear. And I was just getting ready to exert all my feminine wiles in an attempt to persuade you to help me, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, I'm certain that he found you utterly irresistible, my dear Lady Clavering.
You flatter me, Doctor.
No, I mean it.
The professor tells me that you're in need of a little advice, Lady Clavering.
Yes, Mr. Holmes. I'll put my question simply. 5 years ago, my husband, Sir George Clavering, left me.
Left you? Gracious me, how stupid of him.
I haven't seen or heard tell of him since. I now wish to remarry. But of course I couldn't do that without having my husband declared legally dead.
My dear Lady Clavering, I can't help feeling that a lawyer is the proper man to consult, not a detective.
Perhaps you're suggesting that there was foul play in connection with your husband's disappearance.
Oh, no, Dr. Watson. The Claverings are a strange family, self-willed and headstrong. George and I were not happy together. I think he disappeared deliberately.
You reported his disappearance to the police, of course.
Oh, yes, Mr. Holmes. But they've never been able to trace him.
This kind of thing has happened in the family before, Holmes. Tell them about Sir Nigel, Helena.
Well, he was one of my husband's ancestors. He walked out one day in 1777 and was never seen again.
Extraordinary family. Always disappearing.
George knew of the legend. And he often threatened to do the same thing himself.
But your problem, Lady Clavering, is not that of your husband's fate, but rather of your own freedom.
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
Well, I'm afraid my advice can be of little consolation to you. The law has specified a number of years that must elapse before anyone disappearing can be declared legally dead. I would suggest that you possess your soul in patience until that period has elapsed.
Oh, dear. And I was hoping you'd be able to think of some terribly clever way of getting round the law, Mr. Holmes.
Lady Clavering, sometimes perhaps my methods may be unorthodox, but I assure you that getting around the law, as you put it, is a procedure I do not indulge in.
Oh, dear me, now I've offended you, Mr. Holmes, and it's the last thing on earth I meant to do, I assure you.
My friend's a little touchy about matters concerning his professional honor, you know, Lady Clavering.
Oh, nonsense, my dear Watson. I'm not touchy and I'm not offended. And now, may I suggest we all examine the professor's latest treasures, and after that, perhaps, he'll take us for a stroll on the downs. I'm most anxious to examine those lime pits of his.
The lime pits are about a mile from here. It's a nice walk across the cliff tops.
Well, I'm sorry Lady Clavering didn't want to come with us. A charming woman, even though she did rub you up the wrong way.
A beautiful woman, Watson, but I must confess her charm eludes me. Her lack of concern about her husband's fate seemed completely unnatural.
And not if you'd known her husband, Sir George Clavering. He was a tyrant and a bully, both in his home life and in the village.
Hello? Who's this coming towards us?
It's Timmy. Daft Timmy, they call him in these parts. He isn't quite right in the head, poor fellow, but he's perfectly harmless. Has two passions in life, birds and bonfires. Hello, Timmy.
I've got something beautiful to show you. Oh, it's so beautiful.
Well, what is it, Timmy?
Look, it's in my cap. See? Oh, isn't it lovely?
It's a robin's egg.
I found it when I was bird nesting. Did you ever see such a blue egg?
It's a beauty, Timmy. Where did you find it, my boy?
Down by the lime pits. Oh, I'm going to build a lovely fire on the downs tonight. I'll let you come and watch it if you give me a shilling.
Now, you be careful, Timmy, or you'll be in trouble again.
Timmy doesn't get in trouble anymore now. Not since he had Sir George carried away.
Sir George Clavering used to whip Timmy when he found him on the land.
Timmy, tell me, how did you have Sir George, as you put it, carried away?
I told my birds about him. I told them how he used to beat poor Timmy. And they said they'd carry him off and drop him over the cliffs. and that's what they did. Because he never came back again.
Oh, Lord, here comes Harry, Sir George's brother. Now there'll be trouble. Timmy, you'd better run.
Oh, no. No, Timmy can't run. He'll break his pretty blue egg.
Timmy! Timmy! Get off my land. If I catch you here again, I'll take my riding crop for you.
Timmy hasn't done anything.
Go on, be off with you, do you hear?
I'll tell my birds about you. That's what I'll do. Oh, don't forget my bonfire.
Infernal scoundrel. Hello, Whitnall.
Hello, Harry. Have you met Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson?
Oh, Sherlock Holmes, the professional nosy Parker, eh? Yes, yes, Helena was just telling me about you. I'm very angry with her for talking to you about my brother. Private affair, and I intend it should remain one. You understand, Holmes?
Well, upon my soul.
The devil with your brother, sir. And with you. I'd advise you to remember that you're not addressing a half-witted villager who can't defend himself.
If you know what's good for you, you'll do what I say. Here, miss.
Impertinent brute. He spoke to you as if you were a stable boy, Holmes.
Oh, really? He was quite refreshing. I'm reminded of an apposite quotation of my young friend James Elroy Flecker. Thine impudence hath a monstrous beauty, likened to the hindquarters of an elephant.
Yeah. He's almost as much disliked as his brother before him.
Tell me, does he succeed to the title when his brother is declared legally dead?
Oh, yes, and what's more, he's Helena's unofficial fiancé, worse luck.
I see. Personally, I'm beginning to get a trifle bored with the affairs of the Clavering family. Let's go on to the Lime Cave, shall we?
Caves are amazing. We must be 50 feet below the level of the ground, aren't we, Whitnall?
Well, more than that, I should say.
Rock formation is most unusual. A series of caves connected by a veritable honeycomb of tunneling.
Yes. I think I'll light the lantern now. It's getting dark in here, and I haven't explored this particular cave before. Yes, I've had a wall cave in on me a couple of times, so you'd better watch where you're walking. There. Now we can see better. Let's go deeper, shall we? But do watch your step.
It's eerie down here, isn't it?
Hello. What's this in the cupboard here?
Looks like a mummified bird of some kind.
It is. A beautiful specimen.
Judging by its markings, a black streak here and bars of white in the tail, I'd say it was a peregrine.
That's exactly what it is, a falcon. Dating back a couple of hundred years, I should say. And in a perfect state of preservation. Well, this is a treasure, but... come on, let's explore deeper.
There's another cave over here. If you hold the lantern up a little, I'll... I see. Good Lord, the whole wall's collapsed.
Watson, you're not hurt, are you?
No, Holmes, I'm all right.
Why, you've unearthed another cave, Dr. Watson. Let's go in. I think we can just manage to crawl through.
Great Scott, I don't believe my eyes.
Magnificent. Whitnall, this is a treasure indeed. A perfectly preserved body dressed in 18th century costume, powdered wig and all.
Yes, and there's no mistaking who it is. Look at that typical beak profile. It's a Clavering, and it isn't hard to identify which one.
You mean the one that Lady Helena told us about this afternoon?
Exactly. Without doubt, this is the body of Sir Nigel Clavering, who disappeared in 1777. Let's search his pocket. We might find some identification. Here's a snuff box of the period. And some coins.
Yes, the inscription of George III is still visible on them. Hello, here's his diary. This is unbelievable. What are you up to, Holmes?
We're examining the body, Watson. This man was murdered.
Murdered? Look at this wound just above the heart. Obviously inflicted with a sharp instrument, probably a dagger. This is interesting. An entirely new experience for me. The opportunity of solving an unsuspected murder committed well over 100 years ago. Glance through that diary, Watson, will you, old chap? Let's see if the poor devil suspected his fate.
Rather hard to read. All the S's look like F's. The
peculiarity of the 18th century writing.
They are faying, well, I suppose I've been saying, they are faying in the coffee houses that my brother, Harry, hath been coveting my wife.
But this is amazing, Holmes. See how history repeats itself. It's an exact parallel of the situation existing today. Harry is coveting his brother's wife, Helena, and Sir George has not been seen for 5 years.
What an extraordinary coincidence.
If it were one. As it is, it's one of the most ingenious frauds I've ever seen. The clothing appears authentic, so do the coins and the faded ink, the paper of the diary, and due to the peculiar mummification of the body, it would be almost impossible to say how long it's been here. Nevertheless, I am convinced that this is a recent corpse, and undoubtedly, that of Sir George Clavering.
Well, what makes you so sure, Holmes?
Writing the diary. 18th century used an S. It looked like an F, it is true, but never at the end of a word. You will recall, Watson, that you were reading H-A-F, half, for H-A-S, half.
That's perfectly true, I was.
Well, that would be incorrect and genuine 18th century writing. No, obviously, this is an extremely clever attempt to disguise the comparatively recent murder of Sir George Clavering.
That's incredible, Holmes. And yet I believe you're right.
I'm sure of it.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
Do? You and I, old chap, will mount guard over the body. You, my dear Whitnall, if you don't mind, will be good enough to go and fetch the police.
Holmes.
Yes, old chap?
What do you suppose is keeping the police? Whitnall must have gone over an hour. And the lantern with him. Here we are, crouching in the dark in a smelly cave, 50 feet under the cliffs, with a mummified corpse.
I do, Watson, but I don't. Uh-huh. Here comes the lantern.
It must be Whitnall and the police. Whitnall!
That you, Whitnall?
That lantern's blinding me. Is that you, Whitnall? Answer, can't you? Look out, Watson!
Dr. Watson's story will continue in just a second. And I'm going to take that second to ask you what you think of when I say good food. When you say good food to me, I can see myself really going down on a piece of fried chicken, but really fried, you know, crisp and sort of a light brown. And when I see that chicken, I sure want to see some Petri California Sauterne. Because, believe me, Petri Sauterne is a white wine that's the wine for chicken. That Petri Sauterne has a delicate kind of flavor. Delicate like its pale gold color. But what a flavor, and what a wine. If you want a swell white wine, you certainly want Petri Sauterne. Try it and see. And now back to Dr. Watson and tonight's story, The Case of the Out-of-Date Murder. Well, Doctor, you certainly had me on the edge of my chair during the first part of the story.
Oh, I'm glad of that, my boy.
Say, what happened when Sherlock Holmes yelled out at you in the cave?
I was struck from behind with a spade and knocked out. A second later, the same thing happened to Holmes. You see, we were blinded by the lantern and couldn't protect ourselves. When we came to, we found we were at the bottom of a pit. The walls were narrow and vertical, and I saw no earthly way of our getting out of the trap. But as usual, Holmes had something up his sleeve. My head's throbbing.
Never mind that for the moment, old chap. The coat off in your shirt.
Oh,
come on, off with it. I've already removed mine and tied them together.
Oh, what for?
Oh, dear me, that blow on your head must have been unusually severe. I'm trying to make a kind of rope, Watson, a rope to get us out of here.
Oh, what's the good of a rope unless there's someone on the ledge above us to haul us out? If you think you're performing the Indian rope trick.
My dear Watson, this is no time for your rather heavy-handed humor.
Why do you keep whistling like that? You've been doing it for the past 20 minutes.
I'm whistling for help.
Well, why not shout?
Whistle carries further.
Who's going to hear that?
That, Timmy, I hope. Remember, he was having a bonfire on the tip-top tonight. My whistle is that of a nightingale, a song unheard in Sussex at this time of the year. If he does answer it, I'm sure it'll bring him down here.
Well, I hope you're right. Seems to me that Whitnall and the police will never find us here. We shall mummify just as the filthy murderer intended us to.
Courage, Watson.
It's worked! It's Timmy! Carrying a burning log. Go down here, Timmy!
Nightingale! Pretty birdie! What are you doing down there?
Timmy! I've tied these clothes together to make a rope. I'm going to throw them up. You ready? Catch!
Good. He's caught it.
Now, Timmy, lower it to us.
Oh, I shouldn't do this. They'll whip me?
No, no, no. Nobody will whip you, Timmy. And we both want to give you a shilling to come up and see your bonfire.
Oh, that's different. Two shiny shillings. I'll lower the rope.
Here it comes. That's it.
Oh, I'll throw another in. You first. All right, Timmy, pull away.
Here it goes.
Splendid.
I'm up, Holmes. Now alert for you.
All right. I've got it. Look out now. Here I come.
Thank goodness we got out of that place all right.
I don't see the nightingale. Oh, you must have him inside your coat. Well, never mind. We'll all go up to my bonfire and get warm. It's such a pretty bonfire. Did you ever see a finer bonfire?
Never, Timmy. It's lovely.
It's the most comforting sight I've seen for the last couple of hours.
Oh, just one thing's bad, though. Somebody tried to burn a book in my lovely fire. It must have been when I was off getting more wood. I found it when I came back, and I pulled it out of the fire and stamped on it. See, here it is.
Let's have a look. Hello, it's the diary that we found on the body in the lime pit.
Precisely, Watson. Now I begin to see daylight.
People shouldn't burn books. Books are nice. Books are like birds and bonfires. Well, they're nice to be near. Oh, your nightingale must be cold. I'll get some more twigs to burn.
Well, now that the fellow's gone away for a moment, I can see why we were attacked tonight. The murderer knew that we were going to the caves. He was afraid that his devilish plot wouldn't stand up under your scrutiny. So he watched us. When we discovered the body and sent Whitnall off to the police, he knew that he'd got to get rid of us.
And who do you think that somebody is, old fellow?
Well, that's easy. Only one person strong enough to have knocked us both up and shifted our bodies. The dead Sir George's brother, Harry Clavering.
I think not, old fellow. Didn't you observe as we entered the caves, the pickaxes and wheelbarrows were much in evidence?
Yes, that's right. They were, of course.
Strength was not required under the circumstances. We were extremely vulnerable in the darkness. Any man with a modicum of cunning could have disposed of us, or any woman, for that matter.
Good Lord, you're not
Holmes.
Suggesting that...
Watson!
Oh, Whitnall!
Why, thank heaven you're safer. I've had the police with me for the last hour, but we couldn't find you. You went where I left you.
True. Whitnall, I want you and the police to take me to Lady Clavering's house at once. After that, I wish to lodge information and make a charge of assault and possibly a charge of murder. That, Lady Clavering, is the story of how we found your husband's body.
Oh, horrible, Mr. Holmes. Horrible.
But who in thunder could have planned such a devilish plot?
Yeah, and why did the murderer attack you and Watson?
There, my dear Whitnall, you have the key to the murderer's identity. The man who so cunningly conceived and executed the murder of Sir George could never have bungled the job of disposing of Watson and myself unless he had meant to bungle it.
You mean he didn't mean to kill us?
Exactly. He merely wished us out of the way while the incriminating evidence was removed.
You mean the diary?
Of course I do. You will recall we found it partially burnt in Timmy's bonfire.
Then it was Timmy who...
No, my dear fellow. Surely it's obvious. One person and only one knew that the diary was the key to the murderer's identity. The man who was present when we discovered it and detected the fraud.
Great Scott, Professor Whitnall.
Whitnall, you murdered my brother.
Evan. Evan, you... Oh, no.
I did it because I love you, Helena.
All these years, there's been nothing in my life that meant anything but you.
How could you?
I thought that if George were out of the way, I could make you care for me. And when I realized that you loved Harry, I was mad with jealousy. And so I planned to conceal George's body forever. It was a clever plan. You said so yourself, Holmes. If it hadn't been for you, it would have worked.
Yes, it was diabolically clever, Whitmore, but I'm afraid that no amount of cleverness now can prevent you from paying for your crime. Sir George, I suggest that you instruct the police to come in. Our work is done.
Holmes, Holmes, look there on the point. Timmy's bonfire is still burning away.
Yes. Timmy's a simple fellow with simple tastes.
Why are you so gloomy? You solved the case brilliantly.
My dear fellow, my faith in human nature has been sadly shaken, old chap. Evan Whitmore was a good friend and an old one. Hard to be instrumental in sending him to the gallows.
Well, he richly deserved
it. Yes, I know he did. That's quite true. But it's depressing just the same. Come on. Let's continue our walk home across the downs.
I heard Sir Harry offering you a fee. Did you take it?
No, I didn't. But I did accept his offer of an acre of land on the downs over there near the Abbey ruins. You can see them silhouetted against the sky.
An acre of land? What on earth would you do with that?
Well, when I retire, and I shall retire soon, I've often thought of bee farming. This would be a heavenly spot for such a venture.
Well, I can't imagine you as a beekeeper.
Oh, why not? After a life spent unraveling the tangled affairs of human beings, it would be soothing in the twilight of one's days to study the exact and predictable behavior of bees. Singing masons, building roofs of gold. Ah, well. One day, perhaps. Perhaps. One day.
Well, Doctor, that was a swell story. You know, I'm sure glad we get together like this once a week.
Oh, thank you very much. Next week, why not come over a little earlier for dinner?
Oh, no, I wouldn't think of having you go through all that trouble.
Oh, well, of course, if you feel that way.
Well, say, aren't you going to coax me?
Well, to tell you the truth, I knew I wouldn't have to coax you. Mr. Bartell, I was just going to show you the two thick steaks that I've got frozen in my refrigerator.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I'll also put aside a bottle of Petri Burgundy.
Well, in which case, I'll bring along a very hearty appetite. If you pick the steak, I know it's good, and when it's Petri wine, you know that's got to be good, too. Because the Petri family has been making fine wine for generations. They've owned and operated the Petri business ever since its inception, way back in the 1800s. During all that time, they've sure learned plenty about the fine art of turning luscious grapes into clear, fragrant, delicious wine. And they've been able to take this experience and hand it on down from father to son, from father to son. That's why, when you want a wine for any occasion, you can't go wrong with a Petri wine. Because Petri took time to bring you good wine. Now, Dr. Watson, what story do you have lined up for us next week?
Well, now, let me see. Next week, Mr. Bartell, I'm going to tell you an adventure that occurred to Holmes and me in the shadowy depths of the Limehouse district in London. It's a strange tale of death and terror. I call the story The Eyes of Mr. Layton.
Well, Doctor, we'll be sure not to miss it. And meanwhile, don't you forget you promised to contribute to the National War Fund.
National War Fund? Of course, Mr. Bartell. It's a must.
The money you give to your war fund not only helps the men and women in our armed forces, and it not only helps our allies, but that money goes to work right in your own community, helping make possible many relief and welfare agencies in your own hometown. So let's all be generous in victory. Give to your community war fund. Tonight's Sherlock Holmes adventure is written by Dennis Green and Anthony Boucher and is based on an incident in the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story, The Adventure of Wisteria Lodge. Mr. Rathbone appears through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Mr. Bruce through the courtesy of Universal Pictures, where they are now starring in the Sherlock Holmes series. The Petri Wine Company of San Francisco, California, invites you to tune in again next week, same time, same station.
Oh, the Petri family took the time to bring you such good wine. So when you eat and when you cook, remember Petri wine.
To make good food taste better, remember
Petri wine.
This is Harry Bartell saying goodnight for the Petri family. Sherlock Holmes comes to you from our Hollywood studios. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
This is a firearm safety PSA. No matter how you feel about current gun laws, everybody should know the most critical rules about handling any firearm. Rule 0. All guns are always loaded. Rule 1. Never point a gun at anything you are not willing to destroy. Rule 2. Keep your finger off the trigger until your sights are on target and you have made the decision to shoot. Rule 3. Be sure of your target and what is beyond it. A public safety message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
Gun safety. WMFO, Medford.
Thank you, Digital George and Digital Henry, for that FCC obligation. My name is Arthur, and you're listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Prior to the FCC obligation, you heard, they call it The Life of Sherlock Holmes. I thought it was The New Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, The Case of the Out-of-Date Murder, with an original air date of the 17th of September, 1945. So for the second half of the show, I'm going to play, we're staying across the pond here in England. This is episode 33, Tales from the Black Museum, titled The Postcard. This was produced by the BBC in London in 1951 and then aired here in the States from January 1st to December 30th, 1952. It stars Orson Welles. So hope you enjoy. Thanks for listening.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum, a repository of death. Yes, here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a dictionary, a stenographer's notebook, a clothes hanger, all are touched by murder. Here's a postcard. It's a familiar object, slightly soiled in its passage through the mails. Usual cancellation over the stamp, an ordinary address, 29 St. Paul's Road, London. The message? Oh, yes. On the message side, a drawing, rather well done, of the rising sun.
Rather a conventional representation, isn't it, Sergeant?
Yes, sir. Conventional. Still a rather unconventional matter.
Murder? Yes. Yes, it is unconventional. You know, Sergeant, I've often wondered why they held so many executions at sunrise. Why they end lives at the beginning of the day.
Anyway, that postcard today with the rising sun on it can be seen among the other exhibits in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Black Museum. Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. Yes, here lies death in a variety of forms, swift or slow, merciful or cruel. Death is here, laid out, remembered in detail, and perhaps waiting to strike again. Here's a typewriter. This is an instrument of death. Yes? Worthy of the Black Museum, definitely. The criminal care, the vicious planning that went into its use, till the person who received the letters written on this machine, in desperation, took her own life. There's a child's toy, a tiny metal aeroplane. It's rusty in places. The propeller doesn't turn anymore, but there were fingerprints on this. They placed a killer at the scene of the crime, for which he was hanged. Now, here we are, the postcard. The postcard with its drawing of a rising sun. It's clear at once that a skilled hand drew this tiny picture. In this case, many things were clear, almost at once, and conclusions were drawn. However, that, of course, is the story. The story which begins for us as Alfie Vine and his elderly mother turn into the entrance of 29 St. Paul's Road, London.
Alfie, I refuse to go a step further until you've told me what this is all about.
I'm surprising you, Mums. Oh, you've come all this way. Are you going to spoil it all now?
I'll not set foot in this house until you stop all this mystery.
Oh, Mums. Well, this is where I've got my rooms.
You're living here?
Well, 29 St. Paul's. You know the address.
It's rather dirty.
My place is all right. It's only the outside, and it's cheap.
Alfie, you've not wanted to show me this before.
I want to show you the girl who's waiting upstairs.
Alfie, you haven't gone and got married.
Not yet, Mums, but we're planning, so I want you to meet her.
All right. I'll go in.
They went in. The shabby young man, the rusty, black-clad, grey-haired woman. They climbed the stairs. One flight only. Only one, but enough for Mrs. Vine to see the scabby walls, the dirty stair rail, the untidy hall. Alfie placed his key in the lock and turned it and opened the door. Light from the window revealed a single room. A washstand. A bed. The mother had reason to scream. There was a young lady on the bed, clad in the remnants of a nightgown. The gown, the sheets, the pillow were bloodstained. Why wouldn't they be? The young lady's head had been severed from her body. His mother, given into the care of a neighbor, Alfie Vine summoned the police. Shortly thereafter, he faced Inspector Wood and Sergeant Cross of the CID, Scotland Yard.
It's obvious, Vine, that this Alice Cortland was, more than a fiancée to you.
We was married. I didn't want my mother to think we'd gone and done it without her knowing, so we planned to do it over again after Mum's met her.
Yeah. Where were you last night, Vine?
Working. Oh, you can check. I'm a postal clerk, night shift.
Where?
Charing Cross substation.
Oh, check that, Sergeant.
Yes, sir, of course.
You work nights a lot, Vine?
It's a split schedule, Inspector. Two or three times, sometimes more a week. You don't think I'd done Alice in, do you?
We're not thinking anything yet. Not until we find out from the lab exactly when she died.
Poor Alice. She didn't have much of a life. Nothing to depend on till she met me.
What did she do at night while you were working?
I never asked. We trusted each other, we did.
I see. Sergeant, I want the neighborhood...
The inspector was skeptical. You could hear it in his voice. The story was odd, to say the least. It became a trifle more odd when Sergeant Cross reported...
They knew her, all right. Every bar in the district, but not as Alice Vine. In most places, she was Daisy Cummins.
Inspector understood. Came as no surprise, therefore, when a frightened little man, a Marty Shaw, ship's cook on leave, turned up at the yard.
Yes, sir. I knew Daisy, but I wasn't with her Wednesday night. No, sir, not then.
When did you see her last?
That was Tuesday night, Inspector.
And before that?
Monday, and Sunday too, sir. We had dates, Daisy and me, whenever I was ashore. Always had a few drinks together, at the Ork, at the Rising Sun, places like that along St. Paul's Road.
Mm-hmm. But not Wednesday night?
No, sir. Not the night she got herself killed. No, sir.
Why not?
Well, she had a date with somebody else, sir.
Oh, how do you know?
Well, I saw him, sir. In the Rising Sun. I saw him.
Mm-hmm. Were you jealous?
No, sir. I was with Daisy's friend, Margie. Good looker, too.
Can you describe the man Daisy was with?
Well, I had a look at him. I believe I could.
Well, could you pick him out of a group?
Well, I might, sir. I'd try for you, Inspector. I'd really try.
A
Apparently a step forward is about to be made in the case. The ship's cook gives his description.
Not very big. Slim-like, too. Shabby, but in a genteel kind of way. About 30 years old. Always doodling-like with a pencil. Kind of fella can always pick up a check.
A description. Not much to go on, but a start. Again, the canvases covered the area. And now the various barmaids and tavern keepers remembered a man like that. Remembered seeing a man like that with Daisy, alias Alice. The girl who literally lost her head. However, there were no further traces of the man in question. Inspector Wood and Sergeant Cross went back to the bedroom in St. Paul's Road.
All right, Sergeant. With a fine tooth comb. The whole room down to the baseboards. And behind them, if necessary.
The detectives took the tawdry little room apart. The bed was dismantled, the window shades were unrolled, the washstand and its pipings were completely explored. The bureau was investigated, the drawers were pulled out. Their contents tossed on the bed.
Hello. Here's something, Inspector.
Ah, postcard, I see. Postmarked the day before. Where was it?
Caught in the back of this drawer, between the backboard and the bottom.
Yeah, interesting. What do you make of that drawing, Sergeant?
It looks like the old Jap flag to me. I don't know of any Japanese eating place near here, Inspector. Dear Daisy, meet me at 8:15 at the... whatever the picture means.
It's a rising sun, isn't it, Sergeant?
And there is a rising sun. Where that Shaw fellow saw on Wednesday night.
Yeah, rather well drawn, almost a skilled hand.
An artist, maybe?
Maybe. Possibly the killer as well. Right, back to work, Sergeant. There may be a few more little messages like this.
They found two more, hidden in the recesses at the back of the bureau. And that was all.
It's 1,000 to 1 shot, Sergeant, but we'll try publishing these in the papers. Someone may recognize the handwriting or the sketches. More likely, the sketches.
And someone did.
Larry, this is May.
May, this is wonderful.
Is it, Larry?
Of course it is.
Then why haven't I heard from you in weeks?
After we had our quarrel, dear, I thought a certain beautiful model was pretty well through with a certain artist.
I should be.
But you're not.
Larry, have you seen today's newspapers?
No. Why?
It's quite simple. A girl you'd been sending postcards to was murdered Wednesday night.
How do you know I sent her cards?
They're in the paper with drawings. I know your style. Even in the paper.
I should be flattered, I guess.
I'm not. Larry, the police want to know who sent those cards.
May, will you believe me when I tell you I never killed anyone?
I believe you. I know you.
Then, for old time's sake, will you help me? I'm in trouble, May. Real trouble.
What would you want me to do, Harry?
If anyone asks you, anyone at all, will you say we were together from 10:30 on Wednesday night?
For how long?
An hour or so. Then you went to Earl's Court and I went to King's Cross. Will you?
Were you with her?
Does it matter, May?
No, not anymore, I suppose.
Then try to remember, May, please. 10:30, Earl's Court, King's Cross.
May Hester, artist model, once upon a time in love with an artist named Larry, and now asked to provide an alibi. In fact, asked to provide an alibi which might never be needed. May Hester lived with what she knew for a day or so, and then, half reluctantly, her feet and her conscience took her to an office in the old building on the Thames.
I understand your position, Miss Hester. I'm grateful you came to see me.
I don't believe he killed her, Inspector, but as long as you're looking for him, you won't be looking for the right person, will you?
Well, that's one way of saying it. Miss Hester.
Yes, Inspector?
I think you'd better give me his name.
It's Larry Duncan.
Mm-hmm. Do you know where he lives at present?
May Hester knew. She gave Inspector Wood an address on London's western edge. She left the environs of Scotland Yard. So did Inspector Wood, in company with Sergeant Cross.
Mr. Duncan?
Yes, I'm Duncan.
I'm Inspector Wood, CID. My credentials. This is Sergeant Cross.
Will you come in, gentlemen?
No, thank you. I'm afraid, Mr. Duncan, we have to ask you to come out with us. We need to ask you a few questions.
And it'll be more convenient down at the yard.
Well, today the postcard with a little picture of the rising sun on it is part of the exhibits in the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. And now we continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Larry Duncan was held on suspicion of murder. The inspector was convinced of his guilt. Duncan protested his innocence. The family called in a famous defender, but despite the presence in the case of Sir John Cripps, Scotland Yard charged Larry Duncan with the murder of Alice Vine, alias Daisy Cummins, and preparations for the trial went forward. Sir John conferred with Larry.
How are you, my boy?
Fairly well, sir. Does my prison palace show as yet?
Not yet. I like your confidence, Larry.
I didn't kill the woman, sir.
However, you were seen with her that night. A man, a sailor, I believe, who had been with her the three nights previous, saw you both together in the rising sun.
That's why I asked May to say we'd been together after 10:30 that night.
Well, they have another witness, a tram conductor, who states he saw you leave that house at 5 in the morning.
He couldn't have seen me.
I take your word. But will a jury after that false alibi?
I'll have to take my chances on that, I guess.
Well, we'll see. Perhaps a little further investigation may bring a few more facts to light.
Sir John Cripps proceeded toward a few more facts. But he kept what he learned very quiet. Not until the trial itself did he reveal his strategy, nor the evidence he expected to produce. In fact, the first move came sometime after Inspector Wood and Sergeant Cross had placed the police case in the record. The tram conductor, one Charles Powers, was on the witness stand.
And are you certain, Mr. Powers, that the prisoner in the dock is the man you saw leaving 29 St. Paul's Road that morning?
I am that, sir. Positive.
How, Mr. Powers?
By his walk, sir. He has a kind of a free-swinging stride.
Thank you. You may cross-examine.
Thank you. Mr. Powers, let me refresh my memory. You have said the weather that tragic morning was drizzly.
Yeah, I did say so. It was.
Thank you. And that you saw the man quite clearly by the light of a lamppost.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
And further, that you heard a church clock in the vicinity strike 5.
I did.
My lord, I offer in evidence as a rebuttal of this man's testimony the reports duly attested of the electric light company servicing that district, which contains the record that the street lights were extinguished that morning at 4:37 a.m. This man could not have seen anyone by the light of a street lamp.
Mark it for evidence.
And if it please the court, I have here the duly attested records of the London Weather Bureau. Not one drop of rain fell anywhere in London that morning.
Mark that for evidence.
Thank you, my lord.
A skilled lawyer in action is a fine thing to watch, isn't it? Here was a witness, an important witness, completely demolished. His facts called in question and his responsibility torn to pieces. The prosecution suffered from that, naturally. They attempted to regain their loss with Marty Shaw, the ship's cook.
In conclusion, Mr. Shaw, you identified the prisoner as the man who was with the victim the night of the murder?
I did, sir.
Thank you. You're a witness.
Thank you. Mr. Shaw, were you frightened when you heard of Miss Cummins' death?
No. Why should I be?
Why shouldn't you have been? After all, Mr. Shaw, by your own testimony, you spent Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday evenings with Miss Cummins. She was killed on Wednesday. Why shouldn't you have been frightened?
You mean because I was the next man to the prisoner?
Next man to the murderer, perhaps. Not next man to the prisoner.
Maybe I was.
You realized, didn't you, that your position might turn out to be unpleasant?
Yes, I guess I did.
And you discussed the matter with another lady friend of the deceased?
What if I did?
Nothing. Nothing at all. Except perhaps that from this woman you obtained a detailed description of a certain friend of Miss Cummins, and from that description you picked out the prisoner at an identification parade? Well, Mr. Shaw, answer me. Speak up, Mr. Shaw. The judge and the jury want to hear your answer. So do I.
Yes, sir. I did that.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. That is all.
Another witness's testimony discredited, his motives called in question, the propriety of his identification more than called in question. The courtroom crowd was making bets as it filed out after the first day. The odds were swinging away from the prosecution and toward the young man, who sat quietly in the prisoner's dock, sketching. After all, Larry Duncan was an artist, but an artist wants to keep the record of his experiences, even when his life hangs in the balance. Next day, the prosecution called May Hester.
Miss Hester, how did you learn of this crime?
In the newspapers.
And how did you first connect the prisoner with it, in your mind?
Well, when I saw the postcard in the paper, the one with the drawing on it, it was Larry's, Mr. Duncan's style. I recognized it.
What did you do?
I called him on the phone.
What happened?
He asked me to give him an alibi.
A false alibi?
Yes. He wanted me to say that I'd been with him that night.
And what did you do?
I agreed. Then I thought it over and I went to the police.
Very well, Miss Hester. Thank you. Cross-examine.
Miss Hester, why did you go to the police?
Well, I was afraid, I suppose.
Had you been in love with Mr. Duncan?
That is, yes.
Uh-huh. Was he in love with you?
I thought so.
Have you ever heard of an emotion called jealousy, Miss Hester?
It was over. I had no reason to be jealous.
I submit, Miss Hester, that when you thought it over, when you realized that Mr. Duncan had apparently gone to this woman after his protestations to you, that you were not afraid, that you were jealous enough to want revenge.
That's not so. That's not true.
You were afraid. Of what? That this man might try to murder you?
No, of course not. Larry, Mr. Duncan wouldn't dare to fly.
Miss Hester, when Mr. Duncan asked you for the alibi, did you know the time of the murder?
No. No, sir.
When did you learn of it?
Here, in the medical testimony.
Did the question of the time of the death enter your mind when you went to the police?
No, of course not.
I ask you again, Miss Hester. Can you say you were motivated only by fear and not by jealousy or revenge?
Yes. I was only afraid.
Afraid of what?
I was afraid that, well, even if he hadn't done it and I had to swear falsely, I might get into trouble myself.
And you were willing to sacrifice the reputation, perhaps even the life of the man you loved, because you were afraid to get into trouble.
Objection, my lord. Irrelevant, incompetent, and immaterial.
I withdraw the question. That is all, Miss Hester. Thank you very much.
Thereafter, the prosecution rested their case, or what was left of it. Sir John called Larry Duncan as his first witness for the defense. Testimony was short.
I didn't kill her. I left her at the rising sun that night, around midnight. I didn't kill her.
Nor could the Crown's prosecutor shake his statement. Next and last witness for the defense, one David Wallace, a ticket agent on a suburban railroad.
Mr. Wallace, what is your address?
26 St. Paul's Road.
What time did you leave your house the morning after this killing?
My regular time, sir. 5 minutes to 5.
Uh-huh. Did you see anyone that morning?
Yes, sir. A man going in the opposite direction.
Only one man?
Only one, sir.
Are you conscious that you have a rather free swinging stride?
Oh, I do it on purpose, sir. It's good for you in the morning.
With the permission of the court, I request a small demonstration.
Proceed.
Step down a moment, Mr. Wallace, please.
Aye, sir.
Now then, just turn up the collar of your coat. Ah, thank you. Put on your hat, will you? Thank you. Now, will you walk, please, as you do in the mornings?
Chest out, breathe deep and all.
Please.
Like this, sir.
It was unmistakable, the free swinging stride. It was established that there was a man on proper, decent business walking in St. Paul's Road at 5 that morning. The prosecution had no cross-examination for Mr. Wallace. The Crown summed up. Sir John summed up. The judge's charge was brief and to the point.
In cases such as this, if there is any reasonable doubt in your minds, gentlemen of the jury, it is incumbent on you to give the prisoner the benefit of that doubt.
At 8:30 the same evening, the jury filed back into the box. The clerk solemnly intoned the old question. Have you reached a verdict?
We have.
Again the clerk spoke. What is your verdict?
We find the accused not guilty.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
Postcard, whatever it may mean with its rising sun, reposes in a place of honor in the Black Museum.
We heard Tales from the Black Museum. That was episode 33, starring Orson Welles, titled The Postcard. That was produced by the BBC. I couldn't find too much about it, but it is a, I know it aired in the States somewhere in 1952. My name is Arthur, and you've been listening to The Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org. Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. I'm cutting the show a little bit short here lately just to ensure that there's proper transition time for the following show. I think it's the Shuki Wrights show, because these shows are pre-recorded. Thanks for listening.
Thought I'd shaved you.